We're going to start the meeting now. Before we do, could I ask some of you to take seats if possible, because we want to try and keep that display of literature as visible as possible. There's a few seats in the middle and over here, because also we're going to need to keep the door free for people coming in late. Now, what we've got tonight is a meeting on the subject of nationalism, and the meeting's going to fall into two parts. Firstly, we're going to introduce Cliff Begley, speaking on behalf of the Socialist Party on the question of exposing nationalism. And he's going to speak for about 20 or 30 minutes to kick off with. As soon as his speech is finished, his talk is finished, there'll be immediately an opportunity for people to put questions to him on what he said, and indeed to raise points you may have yourself on any aspect of what the Socialist Party has to say. After we've had this session of questions to Cliff, we'll have a brief, very brief break, and then get straight on with showing the film which we have tonight, which is called Proud to be British, a film made in the 60s by Nicholas Broomfield. And then again after the film, there'll be, hopefully, a further opportunity for a final period of discussion. So, having said that, I won't waste any more time. I introduce Cliff Begley, Exposing Nationalism.
Thank you, Comrade Chairman, comrades and friends. Marxists realise that nationalism is the ideology of the capitalist class. The identification of people with the nation state and the national interest enables the bosses to present society as a struggle between nations in the interests of the people, thus obscuring the real conflict in society between the working and capitalist classes. Now, the workers have no country. We've been dispossessed. And I'm going to try to show to you tonight that the workers in Britain have more in common with the other workers of the world than they have with the British capitalist class. Now, nationalism isn't only the waving of flags, parroting slogans, and singing silly songs. In fact, the best version of God Save the Queen I ever read was by the Sex Pistols, a punk band. But it's everywhere, isn't it, when you're young? Pick up a comic, look at the war stories and everything. Fellow humans, labelled Germans, Nasties, Huns and Japs. They're the enemy. Keep an eye open for them. In other comics, which some people choose to call newspapers, and in the media generally, every event is in some way a contest, demonstrating that one's own side is better than all or some of its rivals. Through nationalist eyes, all other nations are different from us and actual or potential rivals. Our country is superior to all others in art, music, sport, good looks. Mind you, they must definitely have their tongue in the cheek when they say that one, looking at you lots out of the go-by. And cooking. When I was a boy, I used to read Alf Tupper, King of the Track in the Victor. That was great. He used to turn up 5 minutes late for the 10,000 metres, win it by 1,000 metres. That was in Tadcaster. He had another race the same night in Blacklesfield, which he ran to and did the same thing again. Great stuff. But the war stories, they made their point. War is a feature of past society, this in the future. So you better get used to it. Well, in schools, we're taught to look at history from the angle of the British ruling class. Wars are fought in their interests, but they make up these ulterior motives, which is for freedom, honour for the good of the country, and all the rest of it. And other ruling classes in other countries are saying the same thing, but from their angle to their school children. But socialism will be a system of society which will end war forever. It will do this because it will be able to meet the material demands of the world's population continually, thereby eliminating this economic motive for war. Now, blind allegiance to the flag is indoctrinated into children. For example, Section 69 of the General Laws Relating to Education in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, America, goes into the subject of proper display of the flag in schools and continues. failure to display flag as above, required for a period of 5 consecutive days by the principal or teacher in charge of a school, or failure of teacher to salute the flag and recite Pledge of Allegiance, or to cause pupils under his charge to do so, provides for a penalty of $5 fine for every such period. So much for the natural love of a country. I myself, I spontaneously came to a socialist consciousness. You know, I asked awkward questions. Why is the rich? Why is the poor? Why not democracy? Why can't I say who should be the editor of the local paper? But the way society is structured, the church, your parents, the school, their ideas seem to drown that out. So that initial instinct, which I think most people do feel to a lesser or greater degree as they grow up, is drowned out in all the bullshit around you. I remember when Princess Anne came along to open the shopping centre in Hartlepool about 15 years ago. Went along there as usual, the monotonous drone of God Save the Queen was coming out, you know, all the flag waving and everything else. And I thought to myself, what did Princess Anne have to do with building the shopping centre? Why isn't it a bricklayer? Why isn't it that the road sweeper will be cleaning up the streets of the shopping centre long after Annie's gone? Now, there hasn't always been a state, there hasn't always been a nation. For hundreds of thousands of years, man lived cooperatively and harmoniously with communal ownership of resources. If you said to a person then that you intended to set up a nation and a country separate from all others and a state, he'd have said to you, don't bother. We've always lived like this, and we always will. We have no use for nations. But as the material conditions develop, the idea becomes a reality. To say it with world socialism, when we say that it's possible to get rid of world capitalism, which is a system where a minority of the world's population, about 10%, own the means of life, the factories, the farms, the hospitals, are monopolised by this privileged, parasitic class. Wealth is only produced when it makes a profit, when it's sold on a market at a profit for these people who have the ownership rights. Wealth isn't produced to meet human needs. Now, to get rid of this profit system and establish genuine common ownership, not state ownership, where there will still be classes, or nationalisation, the same thing, but democratic control of all the means of production by all the human beings of the world. To meet human needs, the world is rich in technology and resources. We can do this. To meet human needs, not the profit requirements of a minority. It'll never go short. When we sometimes hear the reply, well, we've always had riches and poor, we've always had buying and selling, and all the rest of it, so don't bother changing it. Well, the facts of history disprove that. Societies, you know, don't remain the same indefinitely. They change. Capitalist society will change, evolve. There will be a transformation from capitalism to socialism. Material conditions are here. All that's missing are the cooperators. Us, the working class, who don't yet see that it's in their economic interests to establish a system completely outside of the profit system, to replace one with the other. Now, in a socialist society, common ownership, democratic control, there will be no buying and selling. There will be production for use directly. There will be no wages, no means of exchange, no money. Work will be cooperatively organised on a voluntary basis, and the product of that work will be made freely accessible to all. What a society to go for. I want it. So do you. There's nothing to stop us setting it up. Can be done. Let's get it. Join with us. Now, capitalism has existed for about 250 years. For that, the growing capitalist class struggled consciously towards political power because they seen it was in their economic interests to legalise the system which would function in their interests. And this is what the working class should do. Get political power to legalise a system we want to put into operation. The situation is ripe now. It has been for some years. The profit system forced the nation state into being on the lines of good-sized geographical units, because that's the most efficient way of running the competitive system. The powers of government were to legalise wage slavery and ensure the freedom of the commodity, of which labour power is but one, and exploited accordingly. Why should anyone pay us wages for the use of our mental and physical labour? There can be but only one reason, surely. To increase their wealth further by our work, and not only that, but to increase it by more than the cost of our wages. Wealth used in this way is called capital, and those who use it in this way are called capitalists. So the bulk of humanity is divided into two classes, workers and capitalists, sellers and buyers of labour power. Such a situation inevitably produces conflict. In buying and selling, the seller always tries to raise the price and the buyer tries to reduce it. This is the class struggle. In the Observer of 1979, Mrs. Thatcher claimed that Harold Macmillan had, quote, almost got rid of it. Had he won another election, it would have gone altogether. That's what she said. She obviously doesn't understand that class will always be a feature of buying and selling society. You've just seen the miners' strike, you've seen the teachers, the nurses. This conflict in society is over the buyers and the sellers. And it will continue to go on for as long as capitalism lasts. Don't like living in this society. Now, loosely speaking, the worker may have produced enough by Monday or Tuesday to pay for his keep. But the capitalist keeps him working, keeps him turning out wealth until Friday, because he's bought the workers' labour power for that period. Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, surplus value is produced, of which profit is a part. Now, I used to work for United Biscuits in Harlesden. Lucky me. And I want to take the example of United Biscuits. Their annual report for 1984 shows a profit of about 75 million and a return on capital of about 19%. Earnings per share, that's the amount by which the share price has risen, were 15.8p, and a dividend was paid in addition to this of 7.5p per share. Sir Hector Lang, the chairman, has over 2 million shares in the company, so his dividend last year was £156,000, and the overall value of his shares rose during the year by a further £329,000. This gave him unearned income. He gets this through his ownership of the means of life. We are divorced from it. This gave him an unearned income of over £9,000 a week. That's the average pay of his wage slaves was less than that in the entire year. This is going on beneath our eyes, and we're letting it. This unearned income would continue to go to Sir Hector, even if he left for the Bahamas and was never seen again. Should we be so lucky? For actually turning up to work, he receives his earned income or salary of 96 grand, 1800 a week. Now this earning, I witnessed this earning takes the form of when he came along to hold Prince Charles's hand, to try to bring a little sunshine into the monotonous life of the wage slaves in the factory where I work. Well, the day before, when I heard fellow workers talking about this visit coming along, I'm going to wear the ties, iron their overalls, polish the wellies. Well, I decided my back would be playing me up, the next day. Now, the whole concept of nationalism is designed to obscure, draw a veil over this exploitative process, to obscure the conflicting interests within society. Nationalist ideas are intended to show that all the people have a common interest in the fortunes of Britain. What about the other parties who say they stand for the workers? In the present economic crisis, they're all talking about getting the country out of trouble. Well, this is logical, because they all stand for capitalism. Kinnock, who belongs to the party which introduced the first racist immigration laws in 76, quoted in The Guardian of 18th of July, 83, "We must show that we have positive policies which are based upon the implacable requirements that the interest of the British people must predominate. Starving in Ethiopia will have to work the turn. In the Morning Star, talking about working in the GCHQ, I've got the paper here, dated 27th of April 85. So are communists and other progressives potential traitors? This paper has always argued that communists and others in the Labour and Democratic movement are true patriots. The fight for democracy, peace and working class living standards are patriotic causes in the interests of the ordinary working class people of Britain. Indeed, the real traitors are the Tories, we're told, and their ruling class masters, the US and the multinationals. Dreaded multinationals. This government has consistently put the interests of multinational capital and the Pentagon above the interests of the British people. Now, British capital's all right to be exploited by, but multinational capital, well, forget it. Now, this surely must strengthen the ideology of nationalism going on like that. Can't understand it. It proves that the bogus communists don't work for socialism, but stand for the continuation of capitalism. How can a patriotic cause for the slaughterhouse benefit the working class cattle? The SWP have argued for import controls, withdrawal from the common market in their opportunist career. This is a common one. What about the claim that workers' problems will be solved by recovering or enlarging the country's supremacy? Surely, if the country is doing better in trade, workers are bound to benefit. It's obvious, they say. But there is no evidence at all to back this up. I'd like to see some. In The Other America, published in Britain as a Penguin special in 1963, Michael Harrington investigated the assumptions of Galbraith's The Affluent Society. Using figures from the Bureau of Labour Statistics, he estimated that the poor, families with inadequate housing, medicine, food and opportunity, numbered between 40 and 50 millions of the population of the United States. That's 20 to 25%. As technology has boomed, the statistics show their share in this prosperity has decreased. The period when Britain was industrially and commercially supreme, magnificent British Empire, was also the time of Marx's indictment of capitalism and of Engels' conditions of the working class, of horrifying reports by reformers like Chadwick and Booth, children up chimneys, children in schools working 20 hours a day, and all the rest of it. Great empire, looked after you. Because capitalism has everywhere outplayed its progressive role in developing the means of production, distribution and communication, the Socialist Party does not support the capitalist movement, styling themselves national liberation and anti-imperialist, which claim to gain political power in the less developed countries and by means of a ruthless policy of state capitalism, which they misnamed socialism, to modernise and industrialise the areas they govern. Many of these movements and the regimes they set up are modelled on the Bolsheviks, who, as a determined minority, seized power in Russia in 1917, and by a policy of dictatorship, built up a modern capitalist economy with themselves as the new privileged and exploited class, exploiting class. As far as the people they aim to lead and govern are concerned, their coming to power merely represents a change of masters. There is no liberation. There's no genuine socialism. It's another set of rulers calling it that. Chuck it out. Once again, it has nothing to do, and it's quite unnecessary, since the common ownership and democratic control of the means of world production distribution on a worldwide scale has long been possible. We can work for socialism now. We don't have to work for liberation countries. The means of world production are geared towards a society of free access now. Now, reports of racial thuggery, I was reading in the Morning Star today, racial thuggery is on the rise again, especially in London. Now, is there any truth in the lie that these racists give us? They're pinching our jobs, immigrants and blacks. They get their best houses, preferential welfare state treatment. It's all wrong. The country should be for the whites, blah, blah, blah. Let's have a look at some facts. In 1971, General Household Survey showed that 35.5% of the black population in Britain are skilled manual workers and 30% semi-skilled. 17% have non-manual jobs and 10% managerial and professional. In the economic impact of Commonwealth immigration by George and Smith, the average benefits received per blackhead from Social Security totaled £16.30 a year, as against £28.30 for the whole population, so-called. For health and welfare, £18.30 for a black, as against £18.60 for a white. Local authority housing, 90p for a black, £3 for the home population. So the General Household Survey showed also that 23% of black households were overcrowded, insufficient bedrooms, etc., as against only 6.2% of white ones. And 33% lack the use of a bath, as against 12%. So, are they taking away the houses and everything else? They're just putting worse slums. Yes, but surely they argue, if more immigrants come into the country, it's bound to make the problem worse. But there's always been a housing problem throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. Yet at all times, sufficient houses have existed. It's just that the working class have never had the money to gain access to them. That's the problem. Their situation of poverty, not somebody else coming on the scene. There's more unoccupied homes in London now than the 10,000 families who are homeless. Why aren't they put in there? Simple reason. There's no profit in it for the owners. The homeless can't afford to pay for them. Right, thank you.